Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 55 of Her, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, and her life. Oh boy, today we're going to be talking about what? How emotions are made. I thought emotions just sort of sat there in your brain. I guess we're going to learn otherwise. But before we hop into this wonderful segment, I want to make sure you know that it was made possible by Prevention, which is partnered with Premier Protein to kick off their Spread the Health Healthy Habits Challenge with 6 monthly blogs and videos to show you how simple it can be to implement real lasting change. You'll love the topics including move, nourish, grow, relax, balance. I like them all. So go on over to prevention.com/content/spreadthehealth, #spreadthehealth. Okay, and listen, while you're at it, after this podcast, you got to run on over to iTunes too and rate this podcast, review it, because guess what? I actually read these things. Yep, I love your feedback, love to hear from you. So thanks in advance. All right, it's time for Her.
Her. The podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind.
Her body.
Her life. It's all about her.
So I'm trolling along reading one of my favorite columns in the New York Times, which is Gray Matter. And I mean the stuff upstairs in your little cranium. And I read this fabulous piece. It was all about what emotions are made, well, and what they aren't. And I found it incredibly compelling because it was written by a real expert in the field with a brand new book. And so I want to introduce to all of our wonderful Her podcast listeners, Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett. She is
the author.
Hey there. She's the author of, well, How Emotions Are Made. I mean, you know, that's where it is. And, oh my gosh, what a background. She's a university distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University with appointments at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital in psychiatry and radiology. She also has a pretty cool laboratory called the Interdisciplinary Affective Science Laboratory. That's a mouthful, but there you are nonetheless. And she's been conducting some really bleeding edge work here, and I think we need to hear about it because we're about ready to demythify some funky notions all of us have had about emotions. You know, when you're angry, you have this angry neuron up there or an angry part of the brain that just sort of lights up. I don't know that that's the way it's supposed to be or is in reality. And Dr. Barrett is going to be telling us all about that. So emotions are not what most people think they are they? Your thoughts?
My thoughts. Well, I think that most of us know what emotions feel like, and we think that we do pretty well at identifying emotions when we see them. But scientists have debated for a really long time about just how the brain and the body make emotion. And for really since the time of Plato, the starting assumption has been that the brain or the body contain specific mechanisms for each emotion that we experience as distinct. So the idea is that the brain and the body have one mechanism for anger, one for fear, one for sadness, one for happiness, and so on. In modern terms, the idea is that your brain contains a little circuit, kind of like a light switch, for each emotion. And when that light switch is flipped, we see a specific facial expression, a specific feeling, a specific cardiovascular pattern and a specific movement. So when a snake, you see a snake or you are in a dark alley by yourself and you hear a sound or a thud, your fear switch is tripped and this triggers a startled looking expression, an increase in heart rate, and a desire to run. The assumption is that this switch, this little circuit exists in every human brain and even in the brains of other animals, and that these expressions are made by everyone in the world and also easily recognized by everyone in the world. And it's a really nice story. It's a story that fits pretty well with our theory of human nature and what humans are, how we evolved and how we came to be the kind of species that we are. The only problem is that it doesn't really match most of the scientific evidence for how emotions are made by your brain and experienced in your body.
Well, so here we have it. This is kind of interesting. You know, I noticed that in your book, How Emotions Are Made, and subtitled The Secret Life of the Brain, you're really pushing a new theory of how the brain constructs emotions that could revolutionize psychology, healthcare, the legal system, and our understanding of the human mind. I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's
and,
mouthful.
You know, I know. Well, but you know what's really interesting, and the reason why I'm so fascinated with this, and everyone out there in her podcast land ought to be too, is that this is taking a lot of what we used to think. We were even taught, I know in medical school, I was taught that there was this little circuit and you're going to get to the amygdala in a minute. And everything was sort of an A, ergo B, ergo C. And there you have it. And that this seemed to be fairly generic across the board. Everyone looks a specific way when they're angry. Oh, well, everyone thinks and reacts a specific way when they're angry. And what you're really saying is that in this new theory, that emotions are made differently than what we had been taught. That it's no cut and dry. This is the part of the brain where anger lights up everything. Why don't we just go to that amygdala place? And why don't you explain what we've been classically taught about this one brain structure, and sort of flash forward with your research, what do we now understand?
Sure. So I think since the 1930s or 40s, the assumption has been that the circuitry for fear resides in a little almond-shaped structure deep inside your temporal lobe called the amygdala. This is the amygdala is to some extent like it's the rock star of the brain, in the sense that, you know, most people, even if they know nothing about neuroscience, have heard the word amygdala and have heard that fear, that's where fear lives. And so there have been a number of experiments done to examine the role of the amygdala in the experience of fear, and also in the ability to see fear in other people. And this research has also been done in humans, but it's also been done in other animals, in rats, in monkeys, and in a whole slew of different mammals. But the way science works, typically we find something, we find evidence, let's say, that the amygdala is involved in fear. And then the more research we do, though, the more we find out that, in fact, not all instances of fear require an amygdala. And, in fact, the amygdala is very important for phenomena that have nothing to do with fear. And that's really the state of the world with respect to the amygdala right now. So, for example, in my lab, we compiled what's called a meta-analysis, which is a statistical summary of all the brain imaging studies of emotion. And we've looked to see, well, how many of these studies, these experiments where people are having their brain scanned while they're experiencing fear or perceiving fear in other people, how many of those studies do we see an increase in activity in the amygdala greater than what you would expect by chance? And it turns out that about 30% of the experiments show an increase in activity in the amygdala. So that's more than we would expect by chance. And so what that means is often, but certainly not always, the amygdala is showing a change, an increase in the neural firing during fear. What we also find, though, is that every emotion that anybody has ever studied shows an increase in amygdala activity some proportion of the time. So discussed happiness, anger, and sadness all routinely show increases in amygdala activity when people are experiencing those emotions. Also, you see amygdala activity when people are just looking at information they've never seen before. If it's very novel or if they're very uncertain what it is, you'll see very robust amygdala engagement. And there's also other evidence, for example, like there are these two identical twins. They have exactly the same genes. They've lived in exactly the same environment. They both have a disease which destroyed their amygdala when they were 12. One woman, they're both adults now, and they're both of normal intelligence. One woman can experience fear, but only rarely in very extreme circumstances. Her twin has normal fear experiences. She is able to feel the range and variety of fear that most of us feel, even without an amygdala. And I could continue to give you lots of examples like this, but the bottom line is that we don't have one fear which is triggered by one circuit. What we have is a population of different feelings of fear, different that are associated with different behaviors in fear, right? You can freeze in fear, faint in fear, run in fear. You can laugh in the face of fear. There are many things you can fight in fear. There are many, many things that your body prepares to do in fear. And what your brain is attempting to do is to match the behavior to the situation. So sometimes it's very helpful to yell in fear. Other times it's very helpful to stay silent. Other times it's very helpful to laugh or even tease someone in the face of fear. Your brain is attempting to match the emotion to the situation. So there isn't one fear, there's a whole population of fears. And your brain is equipped to make different fears using different patterns of networks. So the idea is that you don't have one way of making fear in your brain, you have many.
Well, I'll put money on it that, you know, when you're sitting back trying to figure out what to do with this one particularly fearful episode in your life, that the frontal cortex is playing a huge role, needless to say, because that has to be a piece of the filtering in the decision-making about whether or not you should stay silent in this one particular case of fear, or you should scream out for
absolutely.
Help one way or the
other,
right?
Yeah.
Makes sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the first thing I would say is that each mental event that happens, each experience that you have, each action that you take is a whole brain affair. It's not the case that thinking lives in one part of the brain and feeling lives in another part of the brain and that seeing lives in yet another part of the brain. That's a very old way of thinking about brain structure and brain function. And everything that we know about the brain for the last 20 years or so leads us to believe that that's a mistaken idea, right? That instead what you have in your brain are these kind of general networks that are like basic ingredients, and different amounts, different proportions, different interactions can produce different mental events, just like different ingredients, the same ingredients but in different proportions can produce different recipes for food. And your intuition that the frontal cortex is involved is very, very correct. Because part of the way that your brain is working is it's not really reacting to things in the world. It's not as if your brain lies dormant and then waits for a snake to slither by or someone to threaten you or, you know, for you to hear a loud sound and then all of a sudden your neurons start firing. Your neurons are firing in your brain all the time, and that's called intrinsic activity. And what your brain is doing is it's running an internal model. It's basically trying to use past experience to guess what's going to happen in the present moment. And it's attempting to it's kind of preparing multiple guesses at the same time, and it's continually doing this, and your frontal cortex is involved in helping to decide which of those guesses it's going to actually turn into a perception, a feeling, an action.
Interesting. You know, when you talk about this, decision-making, the rest of it, the number one prerogative of the mind-body is survival. And the body and the mind will do some interesting things to help one survive. And, you know, you quoted Charles Darwin, who, and I quote, famously vanquished the notion of essences in biology. He observed that a species is not a single type of being with a fixed set of attributes, but rather a population of richly varied individuals, each of which is better or worse suited to its environment. I always remember it as, it's not the smartest who survive or the strongest who survive. It's those who can adapt who survive. And you say analogously, emotions like anger, happiness, and fear sort of blend into this kind of a context where really what you're doing is you're constantly vigilant. Your brain is obviously always trolling for problems, happiness, sadness, bad events, good events. And then sometimes you're activated into a physical mind-body action. So that's all good. But really, at the end of the day, aren't all of these really just what Darwin talked about, adaptive? We're just trying to stay alive. So
absolutely.
Whether we scream under fear or not, does that
absolutely.
Make sense?
Absolutely, it makes sense. So there's a lot of very basic truths in what you just said. I think the first idea that that you know the goal is survival is absolutely right. It's survival and propagation of the your genes into the next generation. I think as a psychologist and even as a layperson, we sometimes are lulled into thinking that brains are for thinking or for feeling or for seeing. But actually, brains evolved for one basic reason, and that reason is to keep your body alive and well and healthy so that you can thrive, so that you can survive and thrive, basically. In science, we give a special name to this keeping the body balanced and healthy. That's called allostasis. So the idea really is that the more complex your body is, so an earthworm has a pretty simple body, a rat has a more complicated body, a monkey even more so, and a human even more so, it's you know, the human body is bigger, it has more systems, and that means there's more to balance at any one given time. And, you know, the way to think about it maybe is that it's important to keep balance. It's metabolically efficient to keep balance. So the thing that your brain cares about a lot is metabolic efficiency. Your brain is attempting to keep the systems in your body balanced, because that's actually, from a metabolic standpoint, very healthy for you. And when things get unbalanced, it's okay for that to happen a little bit now and then. In fact, it's actually good for you for your systems to get unbalanced a little bit so that you can bring them back into balance quickly. That's what exercise is, right? So we use up glucose, we use up oxygen, and then we quickly replenish and rebalance.
So when I say
keep things in balance, what I mean by that is your brain is attempting, for example, if your brain predicts that it's going to stand your body up, it starts to shift your blood pressure around before you stand so that you don't faint when you stand. So it's attempting to anticipate what your body needs and then meet those needs before they actually arise, because it's very expensive and harmful if it fails to do that. For example, if you stand up and your blood pressure hasn't increased, you'll faint and potentially break something and really harm yourself. So your brain is attempting to sort of keep your body balanced, and it's using feeling and thinking and seeing and all of those capacities it has in the service of keeping your body healthy.
All right. Now, that makes all the sense in the world. And I think people are now beginning to realize, oh my gosh, this survival instinct is pretty powerful and complicated. Well, let's turn our attention over to women. So most people believe that women are more emotional than men. This is a myth, you say. Why?
Well, if you take a group of women and men and you ask them to describe their lives, how emotional they are, women will tell you that they are more emotional than men, and men will agree that this is the case. But if you observe men and women, if you observe them in situations, if you ask men and women, as I have, to report how they're feeling on a moment-to-moment basis across many different weeks of their everyday life, using originally we used little handheld computers. Now it's possible to do it on people's iPhones and other smartphones. If you look at any measure really of emotional response, what you see is that men and women don't, on average, differ. There are some women who are very emotional, and there are some women who are less so. There are some men who are very emotional, and there are some men who are less so. So there's a stereotype that women are more emotional, and it's a stereotype that both men and women hold. And it's also very clear in the way that we perceive emotion in other people. When a man is appears to be angry, for example, we assume that he's not an angry person, but he's just reacting reasonably to the situation. Whereas when a woman appears angry, we are more likely to assume that she's just a bitch, that she's just an angry person. And so the assumption is women and men differ in their emotional natures, but the data don't really support that idea in general.
Well, is it also that, I mean, I'm just throwing this out there. Is it that women tend to manifest certain emotions more than men, and men manifest certain emotions more than women? So, for instance, you know, I think, again, is this a stereotype or not? You know, women are less likely to show this anger thing because of the bitch factor, and so it's a sociocultural reining it in more so than with men, where it's seen more of as a macho kind of gig, and it's much more accepted and approved. Or on the other hand, biologically, is it that men have a tendency to, of the repertoire of emotions, they tend towards certain emotions much more so than women do, and vice versa?
That's not really what the data show. I think the data show pretty clearly that we have a stereotype that women are more emotional than men. And when women are, when they appear emotional to us, we say, yeah, see, she's really emotional. She's a woman, meaning she's overly emotional. She's a woman. And when a woman is not emotional, when it's expected, people think that she's untrustworthy or undislikable or basically a bitch. So women have this emotional double standard they have to deal with. Men, on the other hand, the stereotype is that they're kind of stoic and maybe more rational. So when they are emotional, we usually either explain it away, like, oh, well, you know, it's just the situation, or they get bonus points for being, you know, a sensitive guy. I think in general, though, there's really no evidence that on average men and women differ. There's no evidence that that there are certain emotions even that women are more likely to experience versus men. There is evidence, though, that we have stereotypes and that we apply those stereotypes to ourselves and also to other people. There's also, you know, there are differences in how, for example, parents treat how they speak to small children about emotion, how they teach emotion to their children based on the sex of the child. So, for example, when parents are talking to their daughters, they use more emotion words. They use more emotion language than is the case with when they're talking to their sons. And so, to some extent, women, their emotion vocabularies are somewhat better on average than men's. But in general, that when you give a man words for emotion, he can use them pretty well, and it reveals a range of experience that really rivals any woman on average. Of course, there are individual differences, right? Some people are much more emotional and others are less so.
Well, you know, that also brings me to one other thing as we're rounding this out. Babies. If you look at babies, it's about as primal as you're going to get. And this is before we can really get at a lot of the sociocultural, you know, influences on our children. So you say the babies don't pout in sadness, smile in happiness, or scowl in anger? That parents identify emotions by interpreting their baby's movements and sounds in context. What does that mean?
What it means is that when your baby is born, babies certainly move their faces in all sorts of ways. And those facial movements are definitely meaningful. But babies aren't born with the ability to scowl when they're angry and pout when they're sad. It's not really clear that babies actually experience anger and sadness and fear. What the evidence suggests is that babies experience pleasure and pain. They can be distressed or they can feel comfortable. The intensity of their cry really tells you something about the urgency, the intensity of their displeasure, their pain, and the urgency with which they need attention. But what parents are doing, there's nothing, for example, about the acoustics of a baby's cry that tells you whether it's cold, hungry, tired, or just wants a hug. Parents infer what the baby needs automatically and effortlessly. The parental brain is kind of inferring what a baby needs based on the situation. What time is it? When did the baby last eat? Is it light out or dark out? What's the temperature? And so on and so forth. They're kind of doing very informed guessing based on their experience with this infant and also other infants that they may have known or books they may have read or people they may have talked to and so on and so forth. And so babies, there's beautiful research, for example, by a developmental psychologist. Her name is Linda Camras. She's at DePaul University, and she's studied infants for decades now and has shown, for example, that babies make a wide-eyed face that sometimes in adults we make in surprise. But in the baby's case, they're making this face at times when they are not at all surprised, and there's nothing about the situation that would lead you to believe that the baby was surprised, but they're making that expression. Babies will, for example, wrinkle their nose in disgust when you give them something that we believe to be disgust, when you give them something tart to taste, and then they reach out in the next moment and grab their parent's hand to try to get that spoon back in their mouth because they want that tart taste again.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, well, in the same way.
Makes sense.
Yeah. In the same way.
It really makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, my husband, for example, scowls. He makes a classic what scientists believe to be an anger expression when he's concentrating. He's not in any way angry. He's just really concentrating hard trying to solve some problem. There is evidence that people make certain types of facial movements, and babies do too, but they don't necessarily have that stereotypic emotional meaning all the time.
Well, you know, I'm laughing about this because I remember hearing from my parents and, you know, family members as they were taking care of me when I was an infant. Instead of doing a lot of the sort of hyper excitable, oh boy, isn't this wonderful, I just sort of sat there. And I remember the feeling I had, boredom. I was kind of like, where's first grade, second grade, and can we get on to high school already? That ended up being an issue that followed me everywhere. I ended up being in mostly advanced placement classes in high school because I go from zero to boredom. And so where my parents were reading, you know, anything from, you know, maybe distress almost to mm-hmm. anger almost, I was just plain bored. Mm-hmm. I remember being that way, if it's humanly possible. Now that they think about it in retrospect, it turns out to be a big family joke. But, you know, to your point. Well, you know, as we're wrapping all of this up, you know what I'd love for you to do? Take a moment and, you know, tell our Her podcast listeners how they might be able to take just one nugget of what you've said and apply it to their own lives to improve their lives.
Well, I think I might, you know, I have a very hard time ever saying just one thing, so I should tell you, brevity is not my strong suit. You've probably figured that out already.
No.
I would say, first of all, your certainty that you know how someone else feels is not really a good guide to whether or not you're right. What your brain is doing is making a guess based on your experience with this person and with people in general, making a guess about what those facial movements mean, what does that body posture mean, what does that tone of voice mean. So don't presume to know. Be curious about what other people's emotions are. You know, I think that actually can forestall or even avoid major interpersonal conflicts. I think another thing to think about is the way that your brain works, it's kind of collecting experiences that it can use to make predictions and anticipate in the future what are the best feelings and actions to take. So curating experiences, you know, giving yourself the opportunity to experience new things, to learn new emotion words, these are things that actually really help prepare your brain to build a better emotional life in the future. I often tell people, if you're trying to manage your emotions in the moment, you know, you're trying to feel something that you don't, or you're trying to avoid feeling something that you do, that's actually the hardest way to control your emotional life. An easier way, it's really hard for people, and it's very costly in an energy sense. An easier way, though, is to think about cultivating many experiences for yourself to kind of seed your brain, to provide your brain with the variety of experiences that it can just use automatically on the fly in the future. The more experiences you have of anger, the more experiences of gratitude you have, the more variety that you can create in your emotional life in the present, the better equipped you are to have a healthy emotional life in the future.
And also to be able to adapt to life in general. Everyone out there in Her podcast, Len, we've been talking to Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett. She is the author of a totally cool book called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. And one of the biggest takeaways is women aren't any more emotional about life than men. That's been a myth. We've been demythifying a lot here. Run on over to Dr. Barrett's website. It's Lisa Feldman Barrett. That's two R's and two T's .com to learn more about her wonderful research, her book, and even more. Dr. Barrett, thank you for being on the Her podcast. Yeah, we like this. All right, everyone out there, remember to catch every episode of Her. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And then, of course, run on over there to iTunes and leave us a nice rate and a review, because you know something? We love it, love it, love it when you do that, and we love to hear from you. We read these things, you know? So there you have it. I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Follow me on Twitter at PamPeekMD. And you can also check out our Her show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening, and stay well.